Yes, guilty.
Yeah.
Guilty. I had dinosaur bedspreads and pillows and sheets. And then I had the, I still remember having a Return of the Jedi bean bag, which was my
one of
my most treasured items. And I've got rid of it. Unfortunately, I've looked up on eBay and they are worth a fortune now.
That hurts.
Yeah, it
does. Indeed. Now, tell us the difference between a pterosaur and a pterodactyl.
Okay, so look, back in the old days, everyone just called them pterodactyls. Now, technically, a pterodactyl is a much more inclusive group that belong to the pterosaurs. So the word pterosaur basically encapsulates all of the flying reptiles that were around, you know, with the dinosaurs, whereas pterodactyls are just one sort of group within those pterosaurs.
Which do we have in Australia? I've never heard of having pterodactyls.
Unfortunately, we don't have pterodactyls. Well, not yet. None have been found yet. What we have is a group, and some people call them Anithocyridae, which is a hell of a word. Another sort of group of researchers call them Ananguiridae. So depending which camp you're in, essentially, they are the same beasties. But that's what we're finding in Australia, and predominantly 95% of pterosaur fossils are coming from sort of central western Queensland, from around the townships of Richmond and Boolia and places like around those sort of localities.
What makes them such good places, Tim, for these fossils to have survived in pretty good condition?
Well, the thing was, is back when these pterosaurs were living, which was 100 million years ago, roughly, all that area was actually a huge sea called the Erromanga Sea. And so what's happened is we believe that these pterosaurs were living in close proximity to the sea, because we also believe that they were fish eaters. And so we thought, well, what's happened here is the fossils, one day a pterosaur was perhaps flying over the sea, dies, lands in the water, sinks to the bottom. Now, the bottom of this sea was very low in oxygen, which is ideal for fossil preservation. So that's why we're finding a lot of pterosaur fossils, and also a hell of a lot of marine reptiles like ichthyosaurs and plesiosaurs and chronosaurus and those wonderful beasts as well. So, yeah, the conditions were quite right for fossil preservation. So,
how big was the average pterosaur?
Well, the ones I'm looking at the moment, their skull was in the order of around about 80 centimetres to a metre long, perhaps longer.
Mm-hmm.
So these are very big, long skulls, and inside these skulls are very big, long teeth. You know, some of these teeth get up to in the order of around sort of 4 to 5 centimetres long.
Whoa.
And they're very sharp, very, you know, just made, perfectly made for catching slippery things like fish.
Well, do we know that they were fish eaters? What would give that away?
That's still a working hypothesis, obviously. But based on animals that are around today, we kind of that have a similar dentition, and they're fish eaters, or you know, they we can kind of assume that the use of teeth was pretty much the same. They used teeth back then for the same thing reasons and animals that they. Modern day animals use their teeth for as well. So, and also just on the size, some of these pterosaurs, like they had a skull a metre long, and then their wingspan was probably in the order of about 4 to 5 metres. So these things were quite large, larger than your average seagull.
Yeah, well, yes. That's much larger.
I wouldn't like flying around today.
No.
Watching over your shoulder.
It's not what you want at all. That's like a pelican sized, I don't even know how long.
Yeah.
About that big.
Pretty much. Yeah, similar length in skull. I dare say that that the wingspan would be slightly bigger in these pterosaurs. And that also means that they're able to soar long distances, basically. They're very good flyers. So when I was talking about the Erromanga Sea, this sea was hundreds of kilometres wide in the middle of Australia and predominantly Queensland. Mm. So these guys, I've got no doubt these guys could soar for, you know, hours, if not days, looking for fish, you know, without having to land. So,
amazing.
These guys were certainly well adapted to their environment.
Yeah. So the specimens you've been able to look at, where did you go to for those?
Okay, so all the specimens I'm looking at are currently located in a museum called Kronosaurus Corner, which is in Richmond. And so I was lucky enough to sort of been given access to these fossils. And so they've been collected over the last sort of decade-ish, but they've just been sitting up there in pretty display cabinets and no one's ever studied them or described them. So I thought, there's a PhD there. So that's what most of my research will be involved, sort of describing all these specimens that have been sitting up there and just seeing, testing the diversity of pterosaurs. Was there more than one? We think there was.
Mm-hmm.
And seeing, how they flew and sort of maybe doing some biomechanical studies on certain elements of their skeleton to see how good of, how they flew and were they well adapted to sort of short bursts of flight or long distance flying, things like that. So,
how much of the pterosaur do we have? Like, do we have full fossils of them or any bits and pieces?
Unfortunately, no. I wish. Other parts of the world, yep, they exist, especially in places like China and Germany and South America and Brazil. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, the Australian climate is not as forgiving. So the way fossils normally appear around here is they basically, the land is eroded and weathered so much that we start to see the fossils pop out of the surface. Now, that's great because we don't have to dig as deep, but one of the downsides to that, of course, is that it has been weathered by water or wind or sand or dirt. And so by the time we get them, they're very fragmented and quite often isolated. We don't find, two elements of the same pterosaur together, which is unfortunate, but that's just the reality of it. But having said that, some of the bits up there are quite informative still. Some of the rostrums that I'm looking at, which is the snout of the pterosaur, the end part of its skull, as it were.
What and can you so tell from the rostrum?
The rostrum. So from that we can work out a lot of things. The rostrum's arguably the most informative part of a pterosaur because we can, the ones I'm looking at had massive head crests at the end of their snouts. And also we can see the teeth, the number of teeth, how the teeth were actually orientated in the skull. Were they, vertical? Were they more lateral? Things like that. So even though they are only isolated bits and pieces, we can still tell quite a bit from these fossils.
Why would they have needed massive head crests?
Well, look, the jury's still out on that one. Mm-hmm. Some theories suggest that that possibly it was used in sexual selection.
Oh. So, hey, girls, have a look at my head crest.
My word.
Come and get a bit of this. Yeah.
And basically we know that from other Pteranodon, which is a completely different pterosaur from North America predominantly, researchers have found enough of those and we're able to almost positively sex them as well. So we know which ones were the ladies, which ones were the men. And it seems at this point that the male pteranodons definitely had much larger head crests than the females.
Mm.
And that's quite common in other animals today. Sometimes it's the complete opposite, as in spiders. The female is much more brilliant and big.
Yep.
But in other animals, it's the male. So in pteranodons, at least, it looks like the male had massive head crests, and that was possibly used for species identification, so other pteranodons could tell, okay, they're a pteranodon, I won't attack them, I don't need to be afraid.
Mm-hmm.
Or it was just to show off for the ladies, look at me, I'm nice and fit. I'll provide you with the best eggs.
Yep. Well, that's what every woman's looking for, really. How big's your crest? And, will you give me good eggs? That's
what
true.
What more could you want?
Have you always been a paleontologist or working towards it?
Well, no. It's sort of been a funny life so far. originally I went through NIDA, the National Institute of Dramatic Art, and studied as an actor, and then graduated from that and spent 10 years in Sydney as a working actor. And, you know, that was great fun. There was some fun times, great memories, and the people I've met are brilliant.
Yeah. So when was this decision that, acting, not what I want to do anymore, I want to go look at dinosaur bones?
Well, it was a slow sort of build-up. It wasn't something that I decided overnight, obviously, but I think when I decided to seriously think about a new career was fortunately enough, I was in touring a Sydney Theatre Company production of A Streetcar Named Desire in the US. And it was there, and I started thinking, well, geez, you know, this is great fun, but I don't know, there might be some more, you know, I might have another calling in life, as it were. And I thought, well, what if I go back and sort of train myself to do something else, what do I love? And that's what really drove my decision. It wasn't necessarily about money. It was, if I'm going to go and do all this hard work again and sort of go back to uni and do this, I need to do something that I'm 100% sure of that is me. And that was paleontology. So, as I said, you know, I've always loved dinosaurs and everything about them, and even their pterosaurs and all that sort of stuff. So in the end, once I decided, it was so much, it hardly felt like study, to be honest, because I'd been reading about this stuff for years anyway, you know.
So yeah. So you're already engaged.
I'm glad I did it. And so now here I am doing a PhD at UQ in the Steve Salisbury lab.
Well, that's just brilliant. Well, it's been great talking with you, Tim. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
It's UQ Dinosaur Lab PhD researcher Tim Richards, who's investigating pterosaur fossils discovered in central Queensland.